Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
La cataracte est la principale cause de cécité évitable au monde. Le métavers peut aider à traiter ce problème. La plateforme de réalité virtuelle, conçue par Fundamental VR et Orbis International, contribue à former des médecins au traitement de la cataracte, pour que davantage de chirurgiens puissent opérer en toute confiance dans le monde entier. Avec la formation en réalité virtuelle, les chirurgiens peuvent s'entraîner encore et encore pour acquérir des compétences. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 5th of April, these are our main stories. The Israel Defense Forces have released their report into the killing of aid workers delivering food to Gaza. Israel's announced that more crossings are to be opened to allow aid into Gaza. And we remember the work of a pioneering feminist author who's died. Also in this podcast, as the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide approaches, we hear from communities about the reconciliation process.
I used to blame the former leadership which forced me to commit crimes, but the healing process eventually made me acknowledge my responsibility.
The Israeli military has released the first findings of its investigation into the killing of 7 aid workers in Gaza on Monday. It said the strike on the aid convoy was a grave mistake stemming from 3 major identification failings. The World Central Kitchen, the charity the victims worked for, said the IDF response was cold comfort, adding that Israel could not credibly investigate its own failure in Gaza. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Joe Floto, told us more.
So the report is the IDF's conclusion of what went on April the 1st that led to the deaths of 7 aid workers. I was taken last night to the Ministry of Defence and shown some of the video evidence that they presented to set the scene, as it were, for this decision-making process that went catastrophically wrong. They showed us some drone footage of the aid convoy where the logo of this World Central Kitchen charity is not visible. They said that was critical. They also showed us some video of gunman who was on top of one of the aid lorries and fired a shot. And so they presented a context in which the drone unit that was operating in the area was under the assumption that Hamas was operating and that this wasn't an aid convoy anymore, that it was a Hamas convoy. However, they acknowledged that they hadn't properly briefed everyone working in the unit and in that area, that a major aid operation was happening that night. And then they said that a catastrophic mistake was made when that unit misidentified an aid worker carrying a bag for a gunman carrying a rifle, and as such asked for authorization to fire a missile at one of the cars. They were given that authorization and they fired a missile. What we also learned was that the aid workers survived that initial strike. 2 people left that car and jumped into the second car in the convoy and drove off and were then struck by a second missile. And there were survivors from that. And they jumped into the third car, which 2 minutes later was hit by the final missile, which left everyone dead.
And what sort of reaction to this report might we expect from both the Israeli government and the Israeli public?
Well, the Israeli government, I think we've already had a reaction, because based on the outrage that followed Monday's killings, the United States president has insisted that things have to change. So what we've seen initially is the response to ramp up aid provision and things that Israel's allies, notably the US and the UK, have been demanding, requesting, pleading for the last few months. Are now being put into operation, namely that the port of Ashdod, a major container port just 45 minutes drive from the north of Gaza, is going to be allowed to process aid destined for the war zone, that they are going to open another crossing in the north of Gaza, the Erez crossing, which was largely destroyed during the October 7th events, but is still an entry point from Israel into the north of Gaza, and that convoys will be allowed, road convoys will be allowed to bring aid in from Jordan, traversing the whole of Israel to get to the Gaza Strip. So those are the main concrete things.
Yes, the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been in Belgium today. He said he welcomed the announcement, the commitment to allow in more aid. But he said they do need to see action.
We welcome the steps that have been announced by Israel, opening Erez as a new crossing point, having shipments go directly from the Ashdod port, maximizing the route from Jordan. These are positive developments, but the real test is results. And that's what we're looking to see in the coming days and in the coming weeks.
And Joe, given the desperate humanitarian situation in Gaza, how soon might we expect to see some movement and these new aid flows reaching the people who need them?
That's a very big question. There will be anxiety amongst some that this isn't going to come fast enough. But one of the things they have to do before they open up these aid routes is to sort out the safety of aid distribution. And the events of last Monday have raised some big questions in the minds of those working for the aid organisations, but also in the military here, about how they need to change to make sure that they don't kill any more aid workers.
That was Joe Floto. Well, even before the latest moves, Israel insisted it did everything possible to avoid civilian casualties. And it offers one key piece of evidence for this. When civilians are potentially in harm's way, it says, it warns them of a forthcoming attack, advising people to evacuate. Leaflets are dropped, text messages sent to mobile phones. But new analysis by the BBC says the information carried in these warnings is often wrong, contradictory, or just plain confusing. The Israeli military rejects this suggestion, but our correspondent Stephanie Hegarty has analysed the warnings and sent this report.
In late December, Salah Ahmed was in central Gaza.
The Nusayrat camp has been under attack.
People were pouring out of a shelter nearby.
I went out and I saw hundreds of people evacuating from the northern of Nusayrat area.
Salah didn't know he was subject to an evacuation warning. When he did get online, he found this, posted by the Israeli army. It read,
to the residents of Burej and the neighbourhoods of Al-Badr, Al-Rawda, Al-Nusa.
The warning had a list of neighbourhoods and numbered blocks to be evacuated.
In blocks 2220, 2210.
Underneath the text was a map of Gaza, with the evacuation zone highlighted in orange, and a QR code that linked to another map online. 2 months into war with Hamas, Israel presented a new system for warning civilians about impending attacks. It divided Gaza up into hundreds of numbered blocks, and an online interactive map helped people to figure out what block they were in. Then the IDF issued warnings on social media, by phone, and on leaflets dropped over Gaza. When blocks were listed in the warnings, people were expected to leave. We analysed all the warnings published by the IDF's Arabic social media channels since the 1st of December, as well as a limited number of leaflets we could find, photographed and shared online. They contained vital information for people to follow to escape to safer areas, but they also contained many errors. Of the 26 separate warnings we found, 17 of them contained errors. One of the most common problems was a mismatch between the text of the warning and the map accompanying it. This happened 12 times.
Here you can see the IDF's Arabic Twitter account providing information for civilians to evacuate specific.
In January, at the International Court of Justice, lawyers for Israel presented one of these warnings posted on social media as an example of the lengths it was going to protect civilians.
To the residents of Khan Yunis, in area blocks 47... 55,
but we found two errors in that warning. 59, block 55 and 99 were listed in the text of the post, but they weren't shaded on the accompanying map. When presented with this evidence, the IDF didn't address mistakes in maps specifically, but said the text of the post was sufficiently clear to avoid any confusion. But people in Gaza have told the BBC about their struggle to understand these warnings, as well as their difficulty getting online to access them. When Salah received his warning, he was in Nusrat refugee camp. The camp wasn't mentioned in the text, but he managed to figure out his block. And then he saw on the accompanying map that it was cut in two. And his family were confused. He left with his children. There were other issues with this warning too. We struggled to find some of the neighbourhoods listed. On social media and on a leaflet dropped over Gaza, the warning said that all of the neighbourhoods listed were in the area south of Wadi Gaza, a riverbed that splits the strip in two. But we found two of these neighbourhoods just north of the riverbed. The IDF didn't address this contradiction specifically, but said that when a neighbourhood was listed, it was clear that the entire neighbourhood should evacuate. The IDF told the BBC that these posts were only part of a multifaceted and extensive effort to move civilians out of harm's way, which included millions of leaflets and pre-recorded phone calls and tens of thousands of live phone calls. It said IDF warnings have saved countless civilian lives in the Gaza Strip.
Stephanie Hegarty. He says he rarely uses the word catastrophic, but a senior official with the World Health Organization has told the BBC that it now applies to the crisis in Sudan. The conflict there is a vicious power struggle between the military and a paramilitary group, which erupted last April. Richard Brennan, the regional emergency director with the WHO, has just returned from a visit to Sudan and has been speaking to my colleague, Joe Inwood.
This is one of the largest and most acute humanitarian crises in the world. 24.8 million people needing humanitarian assistance, more people displaced acutely than any other crisis in the world right now. Still high levels of violence and very limited access for humanitarian actors to reach those in need. There's about half the states now where we either have no access from inside Sudan or very limited access. So we're trying to scale up operations across the border from Chad and also from South Sudan and looking at other options. But, you know, I've been working in humanitarian assistance for over 30 years. I rarely use the term catastrophic, but I'm using it for two of our crises today, Gaza and Sudan.
Just to explain to people, or for you to explain to us, what are the health, what are the various crises we're actually seeing? Because you say it's catastrophic. How does that manifest itself?
Well, first of all, high levels of violence persist. So, I mean, our estimates are well short of probably the reality because we just can't get there to document. But we know there's been over 14,000 violent deaths and over 35,000 injuries. That's the first thing. Secondly, we've got at least five disease outbreaks ongoing, cholera, measles, malaria, dengue, and so on, what we call vaccine-derived polio. Thirdly, there's soaring levels of food insecurity and malnutrition. We estimate now that 17 million people are what we call acutely food insecure, and that translates into about half the kids under the age of five being acutely malnourished.
I realise we probably haven't explained that we have two sides here. You've got the Sudanese National Army and the Rapid Support Forces. One is the National Army and the other is a sort of a paramilitary force who are fighting over the country. Are you finding that the issues are worse in the areas controlled by one group or the other? How's the balance in terms of where the harm is?
Well, I would say on balance, yes. The areas that are controlled by the RSF, we have less access. The areas controlled by the RSF, there would be higher levels of violence. But it's a very difficult operating environment regardless. Again, there's been major disruption of basic infrastructure, including hospitals and water systems and so on, right across the country.
Richard Brennan. Lynn Reed Banks, who has died at the age of 94, was one of the first women in Britain to become a television news reporter. But one of her most famous creations was the trailblazing feminist novel, The L-Shaped Room. The film version led to a Best Actress Oscar nomination for Leslie Caron. Lizo Mazimba's report begins with a clip from the movie.
Father? I'm pregnant.
The L-shaped room shocked readers in the early 1960s.
Do say something, for God's sake.
The story of Jane, an unmarried woman who's thrown out by her father when she becomes pregnant, helped to introduce readers to a new style of writing that was gritty and raw, and that reflected the realities of post-war life before the huge social changes of the 1960s swept around the world.
When I reread the book, it was like reading a book written not only by another person, but about a completely different era. I mean, it might as well have been 100 years ago as 50.
She wrote the book, her first, while she was working as a television reporter. The success of The L-Shaped Room helped her to eventually become a full-time novelist. She produced two sequels, but it was perhaps in children's literature that she had the biggest impact.
You're real Indian. You're real!
Most notably with her fantasy novel, The Indian in the Cupboard, where a young boy discovers that when toys are locked inside a magical cupboard, they come to life. She went on to write more than 40 books for all ages and across a range of different genres, in a career that spanned more than half a century.
Lizo Mazimba. Still to come in this podcast.
What the data seem to be telling us is that, in fact, the dark energy is not Einstein's cosmological constant. It's something a lot more interesting and a lot more complicated.
The biggest ever 3D map of the universe, raising questions about the nature of dark energy and its future.
People fixing the world. Brilliant solutions to the world's problems.
All right, let's do this.
We meet people with ideas to make the world a better place.
Trying new things that they're really passionate about.
And investigate whether they work.
The idea is you send in a robot where it's unsafe to send another human being.
Wow, okay.
People fixing the world from the BBC World Service.
Buckle up and get ready to ride.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Thirty years ago, a plane carrying the then presidents of Rwanda and Burundi was shot down, killing everyone on board. It was the spark for one of the bloodiest genocides in human history. Around 800,000 people were killed in Rwanda by ethnic Hutu extremists over 100 days. They targeted members of the minority Tutsi community, but also anyone who opposed those genocidal intentions, irrespective of their ethnic origin. 3 decades later, the BBC's Victoria Uwonghunda, who herself fled the violence at the time, travelled back to Rwanda to find out how communities are reconciling with each other.
We've been driving for a couple of hours from Kigali. We're here to meet a group of perpetrators and survivors, and they're brought together by one Christian organisation that has used cows, which are quite integral to our culture, to help fund the reconciliation after the genocide of 1994.
The idea is to look after that cow, to take care of it together. Christophe Mbonyingabo is the founder of the Cow for Peace project.
So when we give them the cow as a way of creating a bridge to allow their process of forgiveness and reconciliation.
At the age of 24, Evariste killed a neighbor, a family friend.
We attacked from the other side of the road, and we infiltrated the crowd. Some were taken to other places, and we stayed here with others, including Narcisse's mother. I was offered a cow if I accepted to kill her.
And in this group, listening also is Narcisse Rwamucho. The person Evariste is describing killing was Narcisse's mother.
When the genocide stopped, I had lost my parents and my siblings, and especially because Evariste was the only perpetrator close to me. To me, he was not only a murderer, as he said, but a monster.
Evariste went through the traditional Rwandan justice system, Gacaca courts, local community hearings, and was sentenced to 18 years. I arranged to meet two people who had been part of a reconciliation project through their local church in Nyamata on the outskirts of Kigali. One of the people who survived is Claudette Mukarumanzi.
He had a stick and a spear in his hands. He stabbed my back with a spear. After a while, I reached back and removed the spear and threw it away.
With blood running over her face, Claudette sought refuge into a neighbor's house. There, she came face to face with yet another attacker. That man was there sitting with us. He was also listening to Claudette's story. His name is Jean-Claude Ntambara.
I used to blame the former leadership which forced me to commit crimes, but the healing process eventually made me acknowledge my responsibility.
Jean-Claude was also found guilty for his crimes. He was sentenced to community work. There are those who feel the country's not gone far enough. Karine Kanimba is the daughter of Paul Rusesabagina, who inspired the film Hotel Rwanda.
We need to have a real conversation about the truth of our history. And without these dialogues taking place, which have been prohibited by the regime, then there is no clear future.
This is something the Rwandan government refutes and says there have been huge strides in bringing people together and allowing them to talk about what happened. Yolande Makolo is the Rwandan government spokesperson.
The Rwandans are talking very openly about what it meant, whatever background they're from, what they felt about this process of reconciliation, what happened to their families, what it means to be a young Rwandan.
The healing of a country begins with individuals making peace and having the space to do so.
I do not know when I will die, but I felt like if I died without forgiving him, the burden could be on my children. I cannot pass that on to my children.
And that's where we find Rwanda 30 years on. The road has been long, and there may still be a way to go, but there are glimpses of hope, strength, and resilience.
Victoria Wonghunda. Intense rainfall has been causing havoc across southeastern Australia as a month's worth of rain fell in just 24 hours. The biggest city, Sydney, has been hit by major flooding. Our reporter Phil Mercer has been trying to stay dry.
It's been heaving it down all day in Sydney. Roads have been turned into rivers. Dozens of flights, domestic flights from Sydney Airport have been delayed or cancelled. There's been chaos for commuters trying to get home on buses and especially on trains. And as you say, the state of New South Wales today has received, or in the last 24 hours, received a month's worth of rain. There have been warnings of dangerous and life-threatening flash flooding in parts of the Blue Mountains to the west of Sydney and also regions to the south. Warragamba Dam, this is Sydney's main reservoir. It supplies Australia's biggest city with much of its drinking water. It is expected to overflow on Monday. It's currently around 96% of capacity. And when it does overflow, as seems certain, it will increase the risk of flooding in many low-lying areas on the fringes of Sydney City.
How ready was Australia for this? I mean, scientists have been warning climate change is driving intense weather, haven't they?
Well, Australia is a vast island. This is a place that is well used to nature's extremes. Scientists have for years been warning that climate change is making storms and floods as well as heat waves and bushfires more intense. It was interesting to note in the last couple of days we received research from the Australian National University warning that Australia could soon face more intense and longer droughts. And some of these mega droughts could go on for 20 years. And of course, drought is far from the minds of many people. It's not just Sydney that's been affected by this intense rainfall. Parts of southern Queensland, the rain and the thunderstorms are expected to continue well into Saturday. So, yes, Australia well used to nature's extremes, but these sorts of very severe events do create chaos and potentially life-threatening flash flooding as well.
Phil Mercer. It's been more than four decades since the former communist ruler of Yugoslavia, Josip Broz Tito, died. But his resting place in Belgrade might not be final after all. The acting mayor of the capital of Serbia is calling for his remains to be removed and sent to his birthplace in Croatia. Tito, who was married to a Serb, whose father was Croatian and mother Slovenian, remains a controversial figure in the countries that emerged from the collapse of Yugoslavia. Our Balkans correspondent is Guy Delaunay. So why does the acting mayor want the remains removed?
Well, Aleksandar Šapić, he shoots from the lip, shall we say. He's well known for his pronouncements on all sorts of different issues on which he seems to take not a particularly considered point of view. On this occasion, he's basically trying to paint out Tito as being an enemy of the Serbian people, and he has described him most witheringly as an Austro-Hungarian soldier who shot at the Serbs in the First World War, and then in essence implied that he prevented the Serbian nation from reaching its full flowering during the time of Yugoslavia, and at where he's interred now in his mausoleum in the House of Flowers in Belgrade, should be turned over to true Serbian heroes, people like the convicted war criminal Draža Mihailović, who was executed for collaborating with the Nazis.
Tito wanted this to be his final resting place, though, didn't he?
Absolutely he did. And Tito was the greatest believer in the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia that ever there was. He wasn't born in Serbia. He was born in Croatia. He had one parent who was Croat. He had another parent who was Slovene. And he truly believed that it was best for the people of Yugoslavia that they all mixed, that they had families that were intermarried. When you did your military service, you didn't do it in your home federation. You had to go to a different federation. So him being buried in Belgrade, his wife alongside him, that was, as far as he was concerned, his wish. And his granddaughter, Svetlana Broz, has been talking about this idea of moving him. And she says it's an idiotic idea.
But what about Croatia? Any comment from Croatia about the possibility of moving him there?
Now, that's a funny one, Croatia, because a few years ago in Zagreb, they renamed one of the main squares there from Marshal Tito Square to Republic of Croatia Square. And this is a nationalist move. You know, they were erasing Tito's legacies there and putting something, you know, national pride issue in its place. And that caused quite a lot of controversy at the time. But the town of Kumrovec, where Tito was actually born, already has a Tito museum there. And they've said they would absolutely love to host his mortal remains because they reckon that would bring the visitors in big time. They reckon they'd get a million visitors a year if Tito were there rather than in the House of Flowers in Belgrade. So as far as they're concerned, please, we're ready to welcome the former leader of Yugoslavia with open arms.
How likely is that?
I don't think this is going to get very far at all. It's a very serious thing to be talking about moving Tito from this particular place. And Tito's granddaughter rather suspects that Aleksandar Šapić has got the June mayoral elections in mind when he's making these sort of pronouncements, perhaps going after the hard-right nationalist Serb vote.
That was Guy Delaunay. Scientists have made the largest 3D map of the universe, measuring how fast it has expanded over billions of years by using the most precise measurements to date. An international team used an instrument known as the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, DESI, to create the map. One of them was Professor Carlos Frank from Durham University, and he's been speaking to my colleague Justin Webb.
There's two aspects to this. The first one, I think it's a technical aspect, but I think it's mind-boggling. And that is the fact that we are now able to measure fundamental properties of our universe, such as the speed at which it is expanding, at laboratory physics precision, at a precision of 1%. So we're talking about galaxies that are billions of light years ago, that are billions of years old, and yet we're able to measure the rate at which the universe expands to this amazing precision. And the result of that, of course, when you measure something so precisely, you can then question whether the models that we have of the Big Bang and the universe are actually stand up to these amazing measurements. And so what we have found, in fact, well, we've known for 100 years that the universe is expanding. And what was discovered about 25 years ago is that not only is the universe expanding, it's expanding faster and faster and faster as time goes by. And that means that in the universe, there's some mysterious component which is pushing the universe. It acts against the attraction of gravity produced by matter. And that is what we call dark energy. So until now, for the last 20 years, we have we don't understand what the dark energy is, but we sought refuge on Einstein, and Einstein came up with a proposal, also over 100 years ago, that maybe the universe contained something appropriately called Einstein's cosmological constant. And we've lived with this constant now for 25 years, but now what the data from DESI are telling us, and this is very preliminary, I must stress, it's very preliminary, but what the data seem to be telling us is that, in fact, the dark energy is not Einstein's cosmological constant. It's something a lot more interesting and a lot more complicated.
If it is a lot more interesting, and I take your point, there's a lot more complicated as well, but in a couple of minutes, what is it or what might it be?
Well, it is some mysterious form of energy, but rather than being constant, it seems to be changing with time. And that is fascinating because it will force us to go back and reconsider the basic understanding of physics, our basic understanding of the Big Bang, and also our basic understanding of the long-range forecast for our universe. When we thought the dark energy was just Einstein's constant, the universe fate, and I mean in the very, 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 very long term future, was rather boring. The universe would just continue expanding forever, getting cold, everything would be decaying, and essentially not much would happen. The universe would just expand to eternity. And what this new discovery opens up is the possibility that a long-range future might be more interesting, that it opens up the possibility that we might be heading for a big crunch.
That was Professor Carlos Frank. And that's it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And don't forget, the Happy Pod will be out on Saturday, including a rescue from the frozen wilderness in Lapland, some very lovely music doing some very powerful things, and sumo wrestling. You definitely don't want to miss it. And if you want to comment on this podcast, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nora Houle, and the producer was Stephanie Tillotson. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.